welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
We're, as always, excited to be back here for another week of Chicago film conversation. Coming up a little bit later in the show, we've got our No Coast Board of Review for the month of November. Going to be talking about a lot of interesting stuff, including a film that you and I are both very interested in, The House That Jack Built.
Yep.
There's a little bit of controversy around there, not just the film itself, but also its release. IFC is looking at some fines for how they went through this release cycle with the unedited director's cut. So we'll have to get into that, but we'll have our whole board of review. Some new faces there as well. Very excited for that. But right now we've got one of our favorite guests, the Amy Guth, executive director of the Midwest Independent Film Festival. She's here to talk a little bit about their upcoming First Tuesday event, the Best of the Midwest Awards nomination party. It's coming up on December 4th. It's going to run from 6 to 9:30, and that's going to be over at the Landmark Century Cinema, as always, 2828 North Clark Street here in Chicago. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to be here.
So this is huge. We're getting into the awards season for you guys.
That's right. And we're doing it a little bit differently this year. Usually we do the Best of the Midwest Awards at this First Tuesday mark in December. And, you know, I really think, I was thinking about a couple of things. One of them was like, gosh, it's such a busy time to be asking people to come to an awards ceremony. It's not really awards season. That happens after the first of the year and into like early spring. And, you know, I was like, it's, you know, holiday time. You're asking people to, you know, be away. And I think this event is too big to contain into one night. So I really wanted to celebrate the nominees as well as the winners of the awards. And so I've split it into two nights. And so the nomination party, usually in years past, what we've done is released it and with a big announcement online and said, okay, online voting is open. Here we go. And the awards committee, you know, pared it down to, you know, five in each category and opened it for nominations. But so we're going to celebrate it a little bit differently this year because really the focus is about the film festival is a community organizing tool. And I think it's important to really lean on that and embrace it. And so we are having everybody show up and having a big party, and we're screening the five nominated short films, but none of the people know who those people are. No one knows they've been nominated. So it's just going to be, I think, a fun night. We've made some really cool video, like an intro video, and we've had some community members from the Midwest Independent Film Festival family do some quick cell phone videos just in a casual environment saying, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, and these are the nominees for, and then entering a category. And it's really been fun to pull that together because it's also a time in which we're kind of showcasing our volunteers and our team and the people you don't normally hear from, the people that are kind of helping you get settled in or checked in or whatever. So I'm really excited about this one. It's going to be really, really fun.
Well, it's a big jumping on point for people as well. If you have not gone to any of these First Tuesdays, I mean, this is a great place to start because not only are you going to get to know the folks that contribute and volunteer and are part of the Midwest Independent Film Festival, but also you get to watch these short films that you might have missed in previous screenings or you haven't, you know, had the chance to watch at all. And I mean, I love that. And it gives you a chance, even if you've been going to a lot of this stuff, you know, you can catch up, remind yourself, hey, these are the short films. These are the people I want to be watching.
That's
and
right.
Let's be honest. We're getting into the time of year now where you want to be around your family. And as everybody knows, in order to create a movie, it takes a village. It takes a family. And everybody should be coming together within the community to celebrate one another.
That's so true. You know, I think about that so often because, you know, I'm receiving so many submissions all the time, and I watch them. And of course, when you're in the industry, you watch the credits in a different way than if you're just like a random person going to the movies, right?
Right.
You're looking for, oh, that's so-and-so that works at this production house, or that's so-and-so that works here. And you start to notice how many hats everybody's wearing here in the Midwest and in the Chicago film community in particular, but also how much we're all helping each other. Because mm-hmm. you'll see, I mean, there's one name that came up on a couple different projects that are nominated. And actually, there's a couple of names that have come up on a few different projects that are nominated. And one person was in very different roles on the two different projects that, you know, that he was involved in. So I think that's really interesting and just speaks to this wonderful, like, let's just pull together and get your film made kind of vibe here that I really, really love and embrace.
And so many people are kind of a jack of all trades. You know, you meet folks who are in the film community that can be, you know, your cinematographer or a gaffer or a PA, yeah, or an actor even.
Absolutely.
I know there's a lot of actors who dip their toes into like the producing side of things, a little bit into maybe some writing. And it, I think it just provides for a big kind of creative, I don't know, soup that everybody can draw a little bit from and, as you said, help each other get things finished.
Yeah.
That seems to be the toughest part about making a film is getting it actually finished.
Out the door.
And tack that soup onto, you know, not every inviting everybody. No one really knows who's going to actually get to eat. That kind of adds for a little bit of a an extra like little spice into the into the evening.
Craft services are not, you know, not guaranteed on the set.
They are. In a SAG indie, it is. But I think, too, it's interesting when you see these real labor of love projects where we make this spreadsheet when, you know, I'm tracking everything we've shown all year long and I'm pulling out, okay, who wrote it, who directed it, who starred in it, who edited, who did this. So I can nominate in all 11 categories. And, it's not weird to see that somebody starred in it, wrote it, directed it, and probably edited it. You know, not weird. I think that's great. And I feel terrible for anyone who has to wear all the hats.
Right.
But some people want that. And they're like, I have this vision of how I want this project to be. I see that a lot with animation. We get a lot of animated shorts. And I see that a lot where people are like, you know what? I learned this skill. And this is kind of my passion project. And I wanted to see it through. And here's this, you know, short about this crime fighting, whatever. And it's like this cool little animated short. And I think that's so fun when it's like, oh, I just kind of sat there and did it. It took me 2 years and I did it and I voiced it and I did this and it's cool. And you're like, wow, you are literally every credit on there. That said, I mean, I think there's a flip side to that, right? That sometimes you need to say, am I the best person to do it? Which is sometimes you are. Sometimes you're like, I know there is not a better editor than me and I'm going to edit this thing. That's cool. I love that. But I'm the first to admit, like, I'm a good editor, but it takes me forever because I'm so nitpicky about it. Mm-hmm. I'm better off, like, handing that off to somebody and then going back with them and reviewing. Move faster.
There's something, like, super insular about animation, right? It's like the bedroom pop of cinema.
Yeah.
It really
That's
is.
That's so true.
But I was curious, how long is your animation block in the, actual festival?
You know what? We don't have any restrictions on it. So all year long, we can put in an animated piece. Like in Female Filmmakers Night, for example, that happened in August, there were a couple of animated pieces in there that
spectacular ones.
Yeah, they were really cool. And I mean, we do get a lot of animation. For some reason, a lot of it comes from Indiana and Ohio. I have no idea why.
A lot of free time.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Slackers down there.
But really cool. I think that's really great. You know, one of the questions in Film Freeway, our submission platform, is that we ask you to answer when you're submitting your film is what qualifies it as a Midwestern film. Sometimes that's really a stretch. Sometimes people are like, well, I was born in Chicago and then we moved to California and I grew up there, but I sure like it there. Like, no, bro, please.
I go back to my grandma's house for Thanksgiving.
That's right. Like, I visit every year and it's a really cool place. Now, if you say...
So that's what makes my film Midwestern.
Right, that's what makes it Midwestern. Now, if you were to say, I'm not from the Midwest, but my feature is set in Chicago, you're qualified. That's fine. You can do that. It has to be a Midwestern story or by a Midwestern filmmaker.
What makes a Midwestern story other than location, in your opinion? Because I think, you know, that we see a lot of things that are set in Chicago, especially Chicago, because third largest city in the United States.
Yeah.
But, what really makes a Midwestern story as someone who's watched so many of them?
Yeah. I mean, I think about that a lot, right? Because I, many moons ago, was writing about local literature for the Tribune. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my first job at the Tribune. I was really covering the local literary scene. And that called for me to draw upon the canon of Chicago literature regularly to compare it to, like, oh, this is very Native Son, or this is very Upton Sinclair, this is very this, this is very Sister Carrie, whatever, and pull from that a lot. So I think about that a lot. Like, what is the common thread through all Chicago stories or Midwestern stories? I don't know that there is one, because there's not one universal experience. I think there's tends to be kind of a bootstrap it through kind of vibe. Like, it's usually a very determined character who is just pushing through some circumstances. Mm-hmm. We don't see a lot, you know, like the example people always go to on screen is the Friends apartment, right? And Friends, yeah, that apartment was ridiculous. We don't see a lot of unrealistic kind of stuff like that in independent cinema in Chicago, in the Midwest.
Right.
We see that very classic, like, Chicago apartment with that stupid long hall and you can barely open the damn door. Like,
bay window.
Yeah, see that apartment so much. Right. And I think that's cool and that's great. And, you know, and that's fine. So I think it is cool when we feel that kind of Midwestern vibe in a story. It's also cool when you explicitly say something set in the Midwest. Sometimes it is about place and the place is a character in and of itself. Sometimes, particularly when we're dealing, I think, with small towns a lot, it is about like a homecoming, a coming of age, a leaving a place, a coming back to a place, something like that. I think that's when place is super significant. That said, it's sometimes just really fun to just see a beautiful shot and you're like, hey, that's the Bean.
Yeah totally.
That's Michigan Avenue.
We've even, when we spoke with director Kyle Henry about his film Rogers Park, he really captured that, you know, especially with, we're a city of neighborhoods, you know, mm-hmm. and while that is that is changing very much in this day and age in Chicago as things like gentrification progresses and the kind of homogenization of a lot of these neighborhoods, there's still staples of it that you can capture in these films. And speaking of the apartments, I mean, that's usually, from what we've learned, is usually part of the production process. They are literally shooting in their apartments,
right,
in their friends' apartments. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that level of authenticity that it brings to the film.
There was a film that we showed during last month during Advertising Community Shorts Night. And I remember seeing a crew shooting this like not my exact street, but kind of two cross streets right by me. I kind of remember this, but people are shooting stuff in my neighborhood a lot. It wasn't until I saw that film that I was like, I think that was that scene I saw. That's totally the bodega that I go to.
Yeah.
That's the place. And I think I said that during the filmmaker Q&A, because he was kind of talking about shooting around the mm-hmm. city and piecing it together to be one, make it look like one cohesive place based on just kind of scrapping and getting it, like, where could he shoot? And I was like, that bodega is my bodega, and I yes. kind of remember you doing that.
That's where I go to get my Ritz crackers.
That's really interesting, because, like, from what you were saying, Tom, about how you kind of get to watch these people using all of the resources, that, like, putting it all out on the table, right? Mm-hmm. And then other people, when they're watching it, they get the opportunity to kind of make it a part of themselves. And I think that's probably my favorite aspect about indie films in Chicago, aside from the, you know, the narrative or whatever,
yeah.
is getting to have like this intensely personal experience with the movies, which you wouldn't really get otherwise in larger, you know, studio yeah, type of films.
Definitely not.
When you're shooting in, like, you know, so many studio films shoot in like Toronto, because yeah. it can look like so many different cities.
Fake Chicago.
Right, exactly. Right. It's scary. Like, when you go to Toronto, you're like, man, this could definitely be like maybe somewhere in Lincoln Park or Lakeview, or, you know, there's parts of it that could be.
But it's like that Simpsons when Ned Flanders met Canadian Ned Flanders, and then he offered him a joint and he was like, they said the devil would be, you know. Yeah. It's like that.
You're not Chicago. You're not.
But you're not.
Let's get into the event itself.
Yeah.
So I love the Midwestern Independent Film Festival events, because they're a full thing. It's a night.
A whole night.
Exactly. You come in, you've got a cocktail reception at 6 o'clock.
We always have some educational programming,
right,
which I would add that in 2019, we're going to be expanding that educational programming quite a bit. Mm-hmm. To be continued. I'll have to come back and visit again and tell
Absolutely.
You more about that. But I really think every single day, in fact, I even have it on a post-it on my computer monitor, how am I serving the film community? To make sure that all of my decisions are guided by that, and not what is necessarily the easiest or the quickest thing to do, but like, what is the right thing for the community? And I really kept coming back to that, because mm-hmm. when we have panel discussions, we, you know, I love when a new filmmaker will go, you said a word I don't know. You said DCP. What is that? Yeah, and someone will go, oh, well, here's what it is. And they'll explain. I'm like, you have this access to someone who knows what the hell they're doing, who's been there and done that and can help you. Why would you not ask that? And the fact that we have set the space in such a way that people feel comfortable asking a question without prefacing it with, this might be a stupid question, but they'll just ask it. I love that. That makes me so happy. I love that. And I just think more of that is so needed to really serve filmmakers at every career stage. I think we do a lot to talk with young filmmakers, and we, you know, I think it's people come to the film festival looking for mentorship and advice on a lot of things. But then what happens once you've done, your first feature is out? You know, I think there's a lot of conversation to be had around really shaping your career. It's not just a bunch of different projects in a void. You can really be very strategic about it in a creative career. But so more to be discussed on that. But that's something to look for in 2019. So there is, you know, the cocktail reception. People come, they mingle, they talk, they get to know other people. And there's always some cool side projects that start. Every single month I hear somebody going like, oh, that's so cool. I was actually looking for someone who can juggle fire while driving. Or, you know, there's always something like that. Some wonderful serendipity happens. And then the program will start at 7:30. And so we're going to, and this is, you know, like I said, this is a very new thing this year. So we're doing it in a very different way. And then we'll have the awards in January at a separate time. It will not be a Tuesday. It's going to be another day of the week to make it, you know, special night, special date kind of thing. It's the Best of the Midwest Awards. That's the night we actually ask you to dress up. The rest of the time you can roll in and whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the night we ask you to dress up, and it's a little bit higher ticket price because it's our big fundraiser for the year, but it's also, you know, a time to really celebrate these filmmakers. And at that point, public voting will happen. So on Tuesday night, as we are rolling this video that we have created, making the announcements, and once the short films start, voting, I'm going to run upstairs and turn voting live. So people will be able to vote right then. If you have the app, which we'll be promoting here in the next couple of days, you will be on the SurveyMonkey app. You'll be able to sit there and vote right then in the theater or that night at the after party, hopefully before you start doing shots or whatever. But you can do your votes right there and get that done. So it's exciting because then you see people, you see communities rallying around filmmakers saying like, this is my friend's film and I really want it to win and this is what I need. Like, everybody go vote, go do this. So it's a little bit weighted though. So it's one third of it is our team, one third of it is the public vote, and then one third of it is the awards committee, and that's people from the community that are in the family that have been watching all year with awards in mind. So so someone can't like totally game the voting,
right?
But it also keeps us, you know, we can't necessarily it keeps us honest too, right? Because that way there's the public vote, there's the committee, and then there's ours too.
Well, so it's so nice to have an opportunity to like, you know, just influence an award, because, you know, you watch the Oscars, you watch the Golden Globes, it's all cash.
Yeah.
It's all really who spent the most money in a lot of ways. And that's not to disparage anybody who's ever won an Oscar or won a Golden Globe.
No, but like,
it's
so much of it. I wouldn't turn one down.
Yeah, I would not.
I would say this. And like, I think the our process, I've been really trying to open up about and open it up and be a lot more transparent about what our process is from the minute you submit your film to whether or not it like wins an award. Cause I think that's, I mean, I think we owe you, the filmmaker, that much. You know, if you're going to pay the submission fee, and ours are still pretty reasonable, some of them are really expensive, but ours are $25. If you're going to, you know, pay us to screen your film, like every film is going to get watched. We're going to give every single thing consideration. The screening committee is going to look at it and score it. And so in Film Freeway, we have all these tools like 1 through 10 rated on all these different technical points. It's not just like I loved it, or, you know, because you need to safeguard against like your own bias and the bias of the screener.
Right.
You know, you can't just be like, yeah, that you know, actress reminded me of my ex-wife or whatever. I hated it, you know, when it's like a beautiful film.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of technical, we have performance, we have directing, we have sound, we have cinematography, we have original idea, we have all that kind of stuff. And then that automatically tabulates into an overall score, and you have the opportunity to write in notes. And then the scores from all the different people who screened it get taken into consideration. And, you know, I set out some guidelines when I got in there, and I was like, okay, if you give something a 5, that means it really didn't move me either way. Like, it wasn't bad enough to make me angry, but it wasn't good enough to make me joyful. It's just sort of there. It's fine.
Right, sure.
It's passable, but it's fine. But, and then work off of that. So I sat down and like defined what, here, if you give it a 1, here's what this means. If you give it a 10, this is what this means. And I say, yeah, like 7 or above, you're willing to fight for that to be screened. Like, it's pretty good and we shouldn't miss it. And so from that point, you know, getting through that is one filter. And then that's when it's a little, you know, there's a little bit of nuance there, because sometimes I've had to reject a film that's really good just because I just had one just like it. Like, we played, we showed Hesburgh, which is a beautiful documentary about Father Ted Hesburgh, who was the longtime president of Notre Dame. And then not long after that, somebody submitted a documentary about another priest that was a social justice guy. And I was like, I just showed this.
Yeah, we can't do this now. Maybe some, you know, we'll hold on to it. I mean, because
check
you get
in
these,
with me in a year.
So yeah. Is that a luck of the draw kind of thing? I'm curious. Is that like a, did you see the previous movie and then the next one that came in, it was, did you have to kind of pass on it because you had seen a movie that was too similar to it and given it admission? Or,
well, I would say, I mean, kind of, yeah. Like, it had gotten through the screening committee okay, and it was doing, you know, the numbers it received were pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then I see it, and I'm like, yeah, but it's so similar to Hesburgh. And, right, you know, in Hesburgh, once it got to me, I watched 3 seconds of it, and I was like, okay, oh my God, this is really good. And, you know, I usually, like, try to watch, like, all the time, pretty much daily. I'll check in and see what's going on in there. And I... that one in particular, I started pretty late at night. I was like, I'll just kind of see. Because sometimes with a long film, I'll just kind of see, like, what's the vibe? Yeah. And then I'll position it somewhere else in my day that'll be like when I can just sit and chill and not think about it. So I was like, I'll just see the vibe. And I got up, hit pause, put coffee on, and came back. And I was like, okay,
here we go.
Really?
I'm in. I'm doing this. Yeah. Because it was like from the jump, I thought, this is really good. So yeah, sometimes it's that. And I try to say that a lot because I never ever want a filmmaker to be like, I tried and it sucked and I failed and I gave up. I never want that. So I say in the rejection that we send out, I specifically say, we would like to see, you know, I hope that I see more of your work. I will specifically write that because if it's true,
yeah.
If it's not true, I'll be like, great luck to you.
Yeah, we appreciate your hard work. But that's curation.
That's
and
right.
And curation is immensely important. And having something like the Midwest Independent Film Festival going through these films, because it's laborious, both in, you know, having to use your filmmaker brain and also having to use all that empathy to watch these movies and try to connect and go through these stories and have in the back of your head this idea like, somebody worked really hard on this.
That's right.
And whether or not you like it, you have to like keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. So that's why, I mean, the emotional labor of going through and watching all these movies, that's why I always hate the idea like, oh, critics, they just get to sit and watch movies and pass judgment. It's like, no, a good critic really, it takes something out of them and they don't want to necessarily... And that's a good critic, not all
that's
critics,
right,
but a
right,
good critic.
And I would say a similar thing applies to the gatekeeper curator role, because yes. I just made like a tweet thread / rant about this the other day, because I love when people will call and say, hi, may I speak with Amy Guth, please? Speaking. Okay. I have just submitted a film and I know you get a ton of them and I just wanted to put it on your radar. Here's why I think it would be great at the Midwest Indie. I love that. I love that so much because mm-hmm. I am getting a ton of films and I then when I see it, I'm like, oh yeah, this was that person and this is the thing. It doesn't necessarily give them a leg up, but it sure does not hurt them. And it does make me go, oh, where is that one that guy just called about? And
well, then you
find
dig
it.
Through and do the thing.
Because everything will get watched. It sure. might take a minute, but everything will get watched and considered fairly. But it will sometimes make me kind of go to that. But I especially love when someone's like done their homework and they're like, here's why this would work. You haven't played anything like it all year. It's the, you know, it's a different genre than this and it's about this. And now's a good time culturally to show that. Like, I love that kind of, because it says like, you're an advocate for your work.
You got moxie, kid.
Yeah. Kid, you got moxie.
It's but so I think important to follow
it,
up.
It is. It's important to follow up. And also, I think there's this kind of like idea out there. And this is, I've said this when I worked as an editor. I say this now that, it's so easy to feel insecure about your work because it's your, you know, you're putting you're opening a vein and bleeding on a page or a screen or what, you know, it's so easy to feel insecure about it. And to some extent, you kind of should care about it in a, not too neurotic, but, you know, in an emotional way. But I invite you to make this shift in your head. And that is, consider that we're not all sitting there like rubbing our hands together like Mr. Burns and like wait to reject you and break your heart. In fact, if you send me something amazing, like the first 5 minutes I saw Hesburgh, I was like, yes, I love this, right? That made my life easier. In 5 minutes, I knew I'm going to show this film. And I know that basically I have a year of, I don't want to say problems, but like a year of things to solve, right? And that is, I need to fill these programming holes. And if you send me something amazing, you've solved one of those, like you've plugged one of those holes for me. So
good art is a solution.
It is. That's exactly what it is. It is a solution. And so I invite the shift for people to think of their writing or their film or their art or their whatever it is that they're submitting, as thinking about it as this could be a solution rather than like I'm bothering this person.
I love that. I love that very much. The Midwest Independent Film Festival. We've got the first Tuesday, the Best of the Midwest nomination party. It's December 4th, so that's tomorrow.
That's
so
right.
So go get your tickets now.
It's MidwestFilm.com or .org, either one you want.
All right.
Midwest. And how about this? Anyone listening who would like to come, they can get half-price tickets with promo code NOCOAST.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Well, well, well.
And that applies to the premium tickets or the general admission. So instead of 10 or 15, they would be 5 or 750.
Oh, that's cheaper than any movie ticket.
That's right.
And pick out something nice. Use the savings maybe to go buy like a sports jacket or something.
Yeah.
For the
event. So that you can look good at the event.
Yeah.
So get dressed up. It's going to be on December 4th. Again, tomorrow, 6 p.m. to 9:30. So $10 to $15 or 50% off with promo code NOCOAST.
These reels are a steal, people. Come on, get out there.
It's going to be over at the Landmark Century Cinema at 2828 North Clark Street here in Chicago. Amy Guth, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen.
All right, we'll be right back with our NOCOAST Board of Review in just a moment. Until then, stick around. You're listening to NOCOAST Cinema here on WGN+. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to NOCOAST Cinema here on WGN+, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
I'm Connor Cornelius.
And right now we're going into one of my favorite monthly segments, the NOCOAST Board of Review. I am your board chairman, Connor, my co-chairman.
I could be like your cat that sits on your lap and I just get pet.
That'd be super nice.
Yeah. Because you're sort of like the evil mastermind behind this whole thing anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, what I say goes. And if there's any sort of hostile takeover,
I'll be there to scratch their eyes out.
Right. I imagine you as a shaved cat.
Yeah.
Just like straight up just skin.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate that.
Got a great skin. You moisturize?
It's not. No, it's been. We could get into
we can
this
get
later,
it.
Tom. It's
anyway,
just, I don't know.
NOCOAST Board of Review. We've got some new faces here, new chair people, board members here. So I'm going to have them each introduce themselves. Let's start over here, Clint.
I am Clint Worthington. I am a senior writer for film and TV over at Consequence of Sound, and I also co-host the podcast and run the website Alcohollywood. And if I may, can I volunteer for Comptroller?
Oh, yes. Okay. Comptroller. Ooh.
Who's Alderman?
I don't know.
Is that fun? I don't know how that works. Well, we've got another, our consistent member, our most consistent member outside of ourselves.
Hi, it's Matt Spoll again from Film Monthly, etc.
All right. We'll have to find a position for you.
Treasurer?
Treasurer? Is that like a comptroller?
I don't know. I feel like it's higher up because I feel like, and he is like you
he's
said,
a more
he's been
senior
here,
member.
He's been tenured. I feel like he gets like a little bit higher up of a position in the board.
We'll figure it out.
Nothing against you guys. I mean,
I'm not sure what I would be in comptroll of, but
yes. And then finally, our other new member,
Nick Allen. I'm an assistant editor at RogerEbert.com, and I'd like to be janitor.
Janitor. Hell, all right. Yeah, someone's got to clean the boardroom.
That's a really good point. It's kind of
it's musty in here.
It's a little musty in here.
Anyway, so November, we're finally you know, I would say November is a pretty good month generally from year to year. You're going to get some prestige pictures. You're going to get some more holiday leaning stuff. There's some that we're not going to touch on because we've already touched on it previously or that I don't care about. If you want to hear us talk about something like Other Side of the Wind, we have a great conversation about Other Side of the Wind with filmmaker
Jake Wiseman.
Yeah, Jake S. Wiseman. Nice long conversation about that. We're also not going to talk about The Grinch because fuck that movie. That movie sucks. I'm sorry. I didn't particularly like anything past the Boris Karloff like TV special that they did.
What? Okay, well that's bullshit because
you like the Jim Carrey one?
Yeah.
Are you okay. Well, me?
we can talk about this later.
That's later.
Don't be a Grinch about it.
Yeah. No.
Something I did want to say about this month is I'm a big fan when movies in a particular month run the full gamut from like super wholesome and like it just gives you that nice feeling, and then it takes you down into like the ninth circle of hell as well.
Yes.
Which I think we got like a really nice.
It runs the gamut.
Spectrum. It runs a full gamut. Yeah. Exactly.
So let's start off with something that was very popular and brought up a lot of conversation, as a movie like this does, about the role of a critic.
Yeah.
I know Matt shared some tweets that about being a critic and what that means that I really loved. And it was kind of around this movie, Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen biopic that audiences loved. Critics were pretty lukewarm on, I would say, is the most charitable thing I can say. I don't think I really saw anybody that hated it. They were just like, this is okay.
Yeah, I didn't see any people who loathed. I know some people who hated it.
But like in the public eye, a lot of people were just like,
there was no one who was vehemently against it. I would say. I mean, it's like, because I don't think anyone's against the concept to begin with. It's kind of hard to. You'd have to be mad at the execution, which is easy to do, but it's not. You can't be mad really at just the concept.
Yeah. So let's start and get everybody's thoughts. So Clint.
I actually ended up skipping Rhapsody and House That Jack Built because I'm reaching my quota of movies made by monsters this year.
Wow.
I only have so much time on my hands. I'll get around to them eventually, but I had to prioritize other things.
Dude, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bryan Singer, right, was the original director
of... He was one of the original director. Well, he was the original director, and then when they were almost done with shooting, they replaced him with Dexter Fletcher, who did Eddie the Eagle.
And he was in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Yeah. He was. Soap. Yeah. Yeah. And so they brought him in to finish off production. And I wouldn't say you can tell as much as you fear you might be able to, but it does highlight the general incoherence of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the main thing is, like, this was announced back in 2010 with Sacha Baron Cohen playing Freddie Mercury, and then it kind of lingered in production hell, but more like limbo, I guess. And then after that, they decided to make it more of, like, a Queen biopic. But the thing is, the entire time, it's so obviously its DNA is a Freddie Mercury biopic.
Which I think you can't avoid when you're making a movie about Queen,
right?
Yeah, but it's it's so sanitized that it doesn't really have the wherewithal to do anything beyond like a surface level Wikipedia skim, although revisionist, somewhat problematic.
Yeah, I mean,
surface level Wikipedia skim.
I believe it changes around his AIDS diagnosis. Correct.
I heard about this. Yeah.
Oh,
with the Highlander song playing.
Yeah,
too.
They imply that he wrote that because he was. That was about his diagnosis when it was not even written by him, and it was it was for Highlander.
I would like to add that there's that when Walk Hard came out in about 2008, that kind of truly broke the music biopic.
Good point.
Bohemian Rhapsody does not beat that rule.
Like, why does it need to exist? I understand Queen. I don't know of a lot of movies that have been made about Queen aside from probably some documentaries, but like, why was this the movie that was made? You know, I would like to ask you guys for
awards nominations.
Totally. Yeah. And it's accessible enough.
People love Queen songs.
It's accessible also accessible enough when you dumb it down. Well, that sounds crass. When you like simplify it or you smooth down the edges and give it a PG-13 rating and sort of take away the grittiness of the fact that he was a queer man in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
And they kind of... I might be wrong, but I don't even think he's the one who says that he's bisexual.
I don't believe so.
It's like they don't even give him that moment.
Yeah.
But aside from that, they do that and they skim over it. and they, you know, they really try to, they really skim through it. Like, you get like some really quick asides of maybe like establishing shots of what is supposed to be him in like a gay bar with like leather daddies walking around him, and that's the extent of it. But it's so sanitized that none of the drama rings true, and most of the drama is like a dramatic irony humor of like, oh, Mike Myers is the producer and he's saying they won't make it, but you know they make it, and that's inherently funny. Apparently,
have you seen Wayne's World? I mean, clearly do it. I do have to ask the board here, Rami Malek, how do we feel?
I feel like he's been one of the few unimpeachable elements from what I've heard. Is like no matter what your feelings on the film, he's good as Freddy.
Very good.
Yeah. I mean, and I really like him as an actor, and I really that's one of the reasons why I will eventually get around to seeing Bohemian Rhapsody. But, I mean, good for him if he's able to use this as a platform to bigger stuff. But, yeah.
It only takes a movie so far how great the performance is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there have been more prestigious movies that have challenged that, more Oscar Beatty kind of movies that challenged that. And if there's not a lot of story behind this great character performance, it only gets so much credibility. So, I'm not wooed as much by the Rami Malek performance. I mean, maybe his study of the physicality of Freddie Mercury on stage was probably my favorite part about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of anything else, it's a script that needs to be good first.
And Nick,
go ahead.
I was going to say, Nick, you brought up Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, which was it broke the music biopic, and I found that one to be almost a direct reaction to. The two biopics that I think set a certain standard in the mid-2000s, Ray and Walk the Line.
Yeah.
And those were like the zenith of that format of how you do a music biopic, and then Walk Hard comes along and breaks it. And it's funny, I was speaking of Jake Wiseman, I was just talking to him about this the other day. You don't have Walk Hard, and granted, I don't think it was that popular of a movie. I don't think as many people saw it as to like influence the culture that much, but you don't make Walk Hard and then go back and try to do that format. It's broken, it's parodied, and it looks ridiculous. And that's the entire, what I felt throughout the entirety of Bohemian Rhapsody was like, this is ridiculous. I can't believe that we're taking this band and we're doing this to them.
That's the thing, is they even say in the movie, like, oh, we don't do formulas, because they're complete and utter. There's an actual line where they're saying, oh, we don't do formulas because they're a complete and utter waste of time.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's funny. And I was wondering as I was watching it, I was like, okay, who wrote this? It was the screenwriter of Darkest Hour, the most Oscar Beatty, safest movie of 2017. I'm like, oh, of course he made this.
Yeah.
Would you guys agree that this is what I keep reading about it, is that Rami Malek is the reason that most people, like your average moviegoer, that's what the people are going to take away from this movie, right? If it will be remembered at all.
I think that, and also people just like Queen songs. There's a lot of Queen songs, and the movie functions as like a true greatest hits collection, but you get to watch them, right?
It's like a hologram tour.
Yeah.
Because every scene ends with like a really obvious needle drop that isn't self-aware, but it thinks it's earnestly cute.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's also those huge Joseph Mazzello fans who want to see where Timmy from Jurassic Park ended up. Because grown-up Joe Mazzello plays one of the band members.
He's really good.
Is he Roger Taylor? Or
it's those Mazzello heads that are really driving people to the theaters.
Just like holding their Star Kid DVDs. And,
finally. All right, let's hop on over to Boy Erased, keeping on this thread of queer characters. Ooh, Matt, he's lighting up. I don't know if it's a good light.
No, it's not. It's funny. I'm the only one who's seen this here, but...
Ever. Just
yeah, ever. He's the only one in the theater. Yeah.
Okay, what I'm kind of happy that this... I think the last time I looked, this is pushing maybe like 7 million domestic. If this came out like 10 years ago, it would have done a lot better, because it also would have been more timely or quote-unquote groundbreaking. I'm happy more people are not seeing this movie, because I think in a way it's kind of damaging.
Let's get some of the details out there. Directed by Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
This is his debut feature.
No, he did The Gift.
He did do The Gift. Yeah. All right, so this is second feature from Joel Edgerton. Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
We've got the kid from all the sad indie movies.
Yeah.
I can't even think of it. Lucas Hedges is back.
Yeah.
And it's sad I forget him, because I do like his performances. I think he's a pretty decent actor. most of the time. I have not seen Boy Erased, though. Is it Nicole Kidman?
Yeah, Nicole Kidman plays the mom, and she's pretty much defined by her Dolly Parton hair. I thought the movie took place in like the 70s. It takes place in the early 2000s.
Good Christ.
Yeah.
Wow.
And because they have, you know, flip cell phones, same and they're thing. Like playing... I think they're playing Street Fighter in one scene.
Nice.
But then, and then later on, they're like Skype messaging each other when it's like an epilogue scene. But I mean, the main thing is this is what especially pisses me off is that this movie came out about 3 months after The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which came out in August. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that movie and no one saw it. And it was the Desiree Akhavan gay conversion therapy movie starring Chloe Grace Moretz and Sasha Lane. Mm-hmm. And that movie did a fantastic job establishing the conversion center as a place, and it established its despotism and how hypocritical all of its people were, and it played with the iconography of all of its of all the people who were running the center. Like in that movie, like one of the main conversion people is sort of like a shitty, like non-fat milk version of Ned Flanders, and there's like this implicit self-awareness to the movie. This movie has none of that, and it's so dull and rote and just an exercise in misery, especially at this point in time, that's so unnecessary. But the thing is past that, it's, you know, it's ugly emotionally, but it's also ugly visually. It's caked in this it's drenched in this sepia palette tone that's super distracting and really doesn't do much of anything.
Even from the trailer, I was like, this does not look nice.
No, it's excessive, and it also does a thing where it's told in and out of sequence, but not really for any particular reason. Mm-hmm. But then the main thing that pissed me off is that this is a movie that, at its core, and I really don't think this is a spoiler, it just hasn't been advertised, this is a movie about dealing with rape. There is maybe a third of the way through this movie, there's a rape scene in this movie, and the thing is, Joel Edgerton is not a good director, at least not enough to deal with this subject matter in a way that gives it any sort of like dives into the trauma of it at all. And it feels pretty damn exploitative at points, especially when they say, oh, we're not going to go past this, we're going to talk about it, and then they skim through it and instead they talk about a bunch of other bullshit. And it's, you know, that's also the only depiction of any sort of queer intimacy in this movie is a rape scene. So
that's problematic as fuck.
Yeah, and the thing is also on top of that, like, it tokenizes all of its characters. Mm-hmm. They're not archetypes, they're stereotypes, but on top of that, it also tokenizes all of its ethics. So it's not really a movie, it's more of a machine to churn out nominations. I just hope that it doesn't really get anything.
Do you guys feel that it was as problematic?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, you guys have seen it.
Oh, right. Matt was the only one
I'm the only one ever who saw it.
That's true. Yeah.
So a hard skip from Matt Cipolla. Mm-hmm. Widows.
Yeah, Widows. Yeah.
All right, from the great Steve McQueen, and again, not that Steve McQueen. I can't tell you how many older people have come to the theater I work at, and they'll be like, oh, what's this Widows movie? It says it's directed by Steve McQueen. He's been dead for years. I'm like, yeah, dude,
or
this is
so
lost
movie.
Yeah. Yeah. he's directing, you know, a
from
Chicago
Beyond
thriller.
The Grave.
That's actually directed by Orson Welles.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, no. So, directed by Steve McQueen, who we know from 12 Years a Slave, Shame, Hunger, which was a movie I really personally loved, and written by Gillian Flynn, Gone Girl, Sharp Objects, and
co-written with Steve McQueen.
Yeah. Oh, he also co-wrote. Yeah. Well, yeah. That makes me excited. Takes place here in Chicago, starring Viola Davis and
Liam Neeson. Yeah, I got the Liam Neeson.
Cynthia Rivero.
Yeah,
Michelle Rodriguez.
Robert Duvall. When was the last time he was? Wasn't he in like Secondhand Lions? I think that's the last one. Or The Judge.
The Judge.
He was in The Judge.
How dare you forget
when
The
he got
Judge.
That did was he get an Oscar judge. Nomination for that?
Oh, yeah.
Because like, it's Robert Duvall.
Damn. I tried to.
So, Widows. This was one I was pretty excited for. You know, Clint, let's get
sure.
over you, and then
yeah.
Nick,
sure.
give me your impressions.
I finally saw this one. I watched it last night, and the thing about Widows is I still don't know exactly how I feel about it. I mean, I know I'm very positive on it, but in terms of articulating all the complex feelings that it engenders, I think is really fascinating, because at once, Steve McQueen, I think he crafts a really fine crime thriller, but within it is infused all of these different dynamics. I think the regionality is a little, I mean, it's I would still have to work that out, because it's essentially about this like really corrupt alderman race in Chicago and, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff along the South Side. But it's fueled by some really fantastic performances. I mean, Viola Davis is great as always, but Elizabeth Debicki, I don't think I'd seen her do anything near that. Like, the last thing I saw her in was The Cloverfield Paradox.
Oh, wonderful. Good Lord.
Yeah, but the two of them are fantastic in it. Michelle Rodriguez gets the biggest acting challenge of her career by having to act like she doesn't know how to hold a gun. But
does
she's fantastic.
Yeah,
she does. I joke, but I love Michelle Rodriguez. It has a lot of really smart writing, a lot of really interesting meditations about the nature of female power and how that manifests in various things, especially with these titular widows who have more or less lived in the shadow of this very traditional gender relationship where like mm-hmm. the man is taking care of them and they're gone, and they have to they step up to the plate and sort of finish what these people have started. And there's all kinds of crime thriller twists in between. And just as sheer craft, I actually really, really enjoyed it. There's that same like Steve McQueen aesthetic distance you have to get used to, that you have to sort of wade through to get to like those emotional beats. But it really gave me a lot to think about.
I'd like to kind of echo in a way, but it's just this great example of art and entertainment kind of converging to be truly compelling in a lot of different ways, whether you're watching a shot of like a windshield and you're seeing the city kind of pass by in a car while there's a main dialogue happening. You don't see who's talking, but you're kind of watching the background and truly being challenged beyond what a normal kind of blockbuster would do. But then at the same point, like when I saw it, it was every twist worked really well. And I think that's one of my favorite parts about it, is that it's so genuinely surprising and exciting in that way, while also telling a story about these men who are trash and have made this giant mess for these women to pick up. And it doesn't seem like it's pandering, but just kind of slowly adding, like, why haven't we seen these kind of images before, these kind of stories as much in Hollywood? And this movie's certainly an exciting push in that direction. But I really like Widows for a lot of its intents, and it's also its purpose. So mm-hmm. that's my thing.
And I'm a big Gillian Flynn fan.
Yeah.
I mean, I've watched, she's one of the few people that has, seemed to have successfully moved on from writing novels to writing screenplays, something that is...
Something that J.K. Rowling did not do.
Oh, God. I was waiting for someone to say it.
I know.
We went way too deep on that last week. Holy cow. But
we were straight up Luddites. Not erudites. We were Luddites about that shit.
Yeah. And so it really excites me, because I loved Gone Girl and I loved the Sharp Objects miniseries. I thought it was, in terms of just like really well done crime drama. So it was nice to have Widows also be in that similar tradition. I kind of do want to see her branch out at some point. I don't want to say shtick, but like writing damaged women is kind of her bag right now. Hopefully, I can't wait to see what she does next. And also pairing her with someone like Steve McQueen, I think, is a great idea. And it's nice to see Steve McQueen also branching out a little bit. Not that he has a particularly singular filmography, but when the last big movie you made was 12 Years a Slave, is he only going to be strapped to like Oscar sort of things?
Right.
I don't think he wants to be. I think this is clearly a great sign that he's able to adapt the sensibilities, those values, and storytelling and visuals to a movie that's like a blockbuster. You could tell it's a blockbuster.
Definitely his most mainstream movie, but not it's a crowd. There was one woman who I saw it who was just going, yeah! And like throwing
and
her hands up.
And that's so my cool. favorite right, thing right. to see in a yeah. movie is when people right. cheer and have that level of an emotional connection. So we have to touch on this. The movie that shocked a film festival.
That brings us into the aforementioned ninth circle of hell.
I know, right? When you said it earlier, that's what I thought of.
A movie that is now going to get IFC fined by the Motion Picture Association of America. The house that Jack built. Lars von Trier, real-life Nazi apologist.
And you would never guess it from the name.
Never.
Alleged Bjorkaboot abuser.
Exactly. I do have to say, I heard a story that, and this is hearsay, but I heard a story that his name is not actually like von Trier.
No, he added Von.
He added Von so that he would sound more regal, I guess.
Yeah, gross.
So he's got this
that's
new...
Awesome, all the I terrible think. Things he's done, that's somehow the worst.
Could you call me Connor von Cornelius? Cornelius. Just see how that works.
I'll call you Baron Von Asshole.
Thank
how about
you.
That? So
you haven't scratched behind my ears in a bit, Tom.
No, I really haven't. So this is a serial killer movie starring Matt Dillon.
Matt Dillon.
He does an amazing job.
And I've always really enjoyed Matt Dillon, especially when he does these smaller roles.
You mean Dupree?
Yes. He is like, well, you mean Dupree a few more notches.
It's like, yeah. You know,
you may know him from
Dupree to Dupree.
Everybody Ooh, loves everybody loves The Outsiders, but I was always a Rumblefish kid. I loved Rumblefish. And this I think he's a drugstore cowboy, you know, so I really love him in these like kind of sleazy roles. And I don't know if sleazy is the word for this.
But he was in Entourage. So.
He was. That's true. But it also stars Uma Thurman, correct?
She's in it very briefly.
Very briefly.
Yeah, because it's...
In an ironic turn, in a sense, for me, because prior to me finding out about this movie, I had not heard of this movie until after I read the New York Times piece where she talked about the set of Kill Bill and the accident and Tarantino and all this kind of stuff. And I was just like, oh, wow, this is her really coming out against abusive men and all this kind
of
stuff.
And then she worked with Von Trier.
Works with Von Trier and then is in a movie where she is dealing with like the height of abusive manhood, which is like murder in a sense. But maybe that's not the best way to talk about it. I want to touch on also what I mean by IFC getting fined by the Motion Picture Association of America. It has to do, if I read the whole thing correctly, it has to do with the release schedule.
Yeah.
They came out with this director's cut unrated.
Yeah, it's what showed at Cannes, and that's what like over 100 people walked out of, and that was the whole controversy out of Cannes.
And they showed it at the Music Box this week, one night only.
They showed it at Wednesday.
And now we're going to get the theatrical release, which is edited. But apparently that's a problem with the MPAA. You can't have like a unrated director's cut released so close to a theatrical cut.
Apparently there has to be like a 90-day window between different releases.
What a crock of shit.
And it's because it, quote-unquote, like... You know, undermines the effectiveness of the MPAA within the eyes of America's parents or something.
Fucking good.
Because there were so many kids in that
because,
movie.
Like, that's the thing. Wednesday. I was just saying, like, because, I mean, I don't know who is going to be, like, I don't know which version of this Lars von Trier serial killer.
Which one am I going to bring my kids
that's
to?
That's the thing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
PG-13 cut.
Because they were scared that it was causing confusion about which was R and which was unrated. Like, if you go on Fandango, the director's cut was being labeled as R, even though it's really unrated. But, I mean, apparently there's, like, an 80-second difference between the two versions. Which I can kind of guess after seeing what they're going to cut.
It's kind of like looking at the two versions of De Palma's Dress to Kill.
Sure.
You know, there's really not that much difference. There's like...
It's just like, if nothing else, it's more just, you know, tonally abrasive, I think is what would cause the most outrage. But it's... I like this overall, and I'm very ashamed to say so. because this is... When it ended, I'm like, fuck, I actually like this movie,
right?
Because there are parts where so the thing is, it's broken up into six chapters of, you know, him, you know, Matt Dillon as Jack talking to this unseen character who he calls Verge. And so it's like, obviously he's Virgil, and so that would make Jack Dante, and so that would make the movie a glorified retelling of You Can Probably Guess What. And so as you go
Clerks,
through this,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And so as you go through this, you get, you know, five randomly selected incidents of like what defined him as a serial killer. And then it goes into an epilogue. And there, the first hour or so is actually hilarious. And it's meant to be hilarious. And it's, I was laughing my ass off. Specifically the second incident, it's staged and paced kind of like an Adult Swim sketch by way of Man Bites Dog. And it's so funny because it's like he has to lie to a woman that he's a police officer so he can like prey on her and get into her house and kill her. And then he's paranoid, like he has really bad OCD, so he's going to the van and he, like, the cops are coming, but he keeps imagining these blood stains in her house, so he has to rush back in to clean it obsessively. And he's like, oh fuck. And it's really funny and twisted. And then there are these other scenes that are harrowing. There's a scene where he's preying on a mother and two small children who are on a hunting trip.
Jesus.
And I'll leave it at that. And that made me want to die in a great way, though. And then there's a scene. But the thing was, there's a lot of fantastic stuff here, if you can call it that. And then there's a scene with Riley Keough, which is where it gets to the most masturbatory parallels between Jack, because Jack is so obviously a self-insert for Von Trier.
Yeah.
And this movie is like kind of a... it's fascinating at the most when it talks about, like, because it talks a lot about the qualities of art, and I think it's fascinating when it really comes to Von Trier admitting himself to be a failed artist who only shocks people because he doesn't really have enough empathy. And I think that's a pretty nice admission from him.
That's pretty bold.
It is.
And just put that out there.
And that's kind of the thesis of the movie. But there's one scene with Riley Keough as, like, kind of his girlfriend, who Jack refers to as Simple, just calls her Simple and verbally berates her. And there's this scene of sexualized violence that is so unnecessary, not just because of the content, but because it happens almost 2 hours into the movie, and by this point you've already gotten used to the fact that everything in this movie is part of a film. So at this point the shock tactics feel like a slap to the back of the head. So it feels like more of like edgelord 4chan bullshit instead of actual provocation.
That does sound like Lars von Trier,
and it's frustrating. And then also, like, later on, he, like, Jack has a thing where he talks about how he appreciates Nazi architecture, and it shows clips from the Holocaust and, like, concentration camp, like, bodies being plowed away. And that's another thing where I'm like, okay, you're trolling, but you already trolled us by casting Bruno Gantz in the main supporting role, and Bruno Gantz's main claim to fame is playing Adolf Hitler in Downfall.
Yeah.
And so equating the audience, you know, conduit with this, you know, person associated with Hitler, like, you already trolled us enough, and that was a lot wittier. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to do this.
Yeah. Nick, I want to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah. It's definitely for the fans. And
it's like those
love letter, yeah.
Those fucking Backstreet Boys CDs that you got from Burger King in 1995. It's for the fans, you know.
It's like, if you're already engaging von Trier, whether you are truly disgusted by him, or as long as you're just a part of, you want to listen to what he has to say, because we're talking about how provocative he is, for what kind of sake or to what end. And if you're interested in all of these weird metaphors that he makes between serial killing and wine rot or whatever, just like a Nymphomaniac, where he uses fishing as this, like, kind of
the Fibonacci spiral.
Right. So these interesting kind of masturbatory discussions that you do have to be a kind of on the von Trier wavelength or to care about this stuff to be truly engaged by. So it worked for me in that way, but also as, like, a summation of kind of American serial killers and all these different details, I thought that was really interesting, like the crutch and so forth. I would say it's very funny. Matt Dillon's performance, though, for me is like a dark horse, or whatever you want to call it. Like, I'm calling it now, like, best actor Matt Dillon. No, I'm kidding.
All right.
But I mean, it's really good. It should not be forgotten, because it's a true, like, really well calibrated performance of comedy and darkness in a way that's very surprising, I think, from him, but also just proves that von Trier is truly a great actor's director. Mm-hmm. Even if he's, like, doing terrible things to them as well.
Yeah. Interesting. It's something to consider.
I had a question that I want to ask you guys then. The things that I've been seeing, I'm on a few different, like, chat groups or whatever, where some people are more cinephile oriented and some people are more in one, and then in another it's a little bit more of like an everyday kind of viewer thing, you know. So the people that have seen in the cinephile group, they watched The House That Jack Built and they're like, this movie's fucking ridiculous, you're gonna love it. And people that kind of can approach movies from a little bit more of an artistic standpoint and admire the craft and still know that Lars von Trier is a piece of shit. But I'm curious about what you think people's reaction, I mean, I guess the walkout, right, is a lot of people, the normal person, not normal, but the average viewer's reaction, right? Mm-hmm. What do you guys think will be the legacy of this movie writ large?
It's definitely a slasher movie. It's his version of it, but from the perspective of the slasher and with all of the rambling comedy of it and everything. And I think people might kind of shine to it in that way, because we love serial killers. We love crime in this country, in our entertainment at least. So I do think it has some longevity potential in that. But I also think that it is so very much about the discussion of all this stuff in all these weird poetry that he tries to create that might turn people off. But yeah, if you want to see some gnarly shit, bro, I mean, Jack's got it.
Is that
got
the, it. Make it happen. Is that kind of what like you're thinking about when you're seeing? Like, that's the kind of guys.
I kind of like, because I'm such a glutton for punishment. I mean, I don't know what this says about me, and I kind of hate what it might say. Is I haven't stopped thinking about this movie since I saw it on Wednesday night, and it's Saturday afternoon as we record this. But if the Riley Keough segment and like the clips of the Holocaust were not there, I'm pretty sure this would be my top 10 of the year.
Jesus.
Because there are some moments that I absolutely loved in this movie because they made me, because I just wanted to pass out. And then there were some moments where I was laughing my ass off. And I think specifically like the moment with the children and the mother, he strikes a really fine balance between on-screen graphic violence and implied violence. And it also works because he focuses on the victims. And it's just so torturous in the way he intends. And also he said in an interview it's meant to celebrate the fact that life is evil and soulless. And I would say it does this with
it accomplishes
wrong.
That aim.
So there you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's exciting that it exists and that we can – well, it, I mean, it, honestly, that we can have a film that can gnaw at you that much. Like you watch it on a Wednesday and we're still talking about it on a Saturday. You know, whether or not you were on this show, I'm guessing you'd still be thinking about like, fuck, this movie really, really went some fucking places. We're going to skip on Buster Scruggs. I think we've save that for another time.
We've already talked about one pitch black comedy broken up.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding.
And then Wreck-It Ralph, who I mean, it was fun.
It was fun. I like the message behind it.
The Frozen 2 tease thing at the end was so passe and really dumb.
I kind of wish they had gone into the dark web in the movie. Like, just gone,
they did a little bit.
Give a rated R version of Wreck-It Ralph.
Wreck-It Ralph watches internet porn.
Yeah.
Discovers internet porn.
They uncover Russian collusion. They have to run Russian bots. Yeah.
Why didn't they go there? Disney, you have a responsibility. I want to leave it, since you guys are all critics, there's something that Paul Schrader said recently, and I just want to have
them guess it.
Do they know?
That's why we made the sound.
Paul Schrader essentially, I'm going to paraphrase here because it's not worth directly quoting. Essentially said that we need better movie audiences in 2018, and that movie audiences in the 70s were better. I'm going to limit you guys to a minute. You give me a minute response to that about how you feel about it. I'm going to start with Nick.
Yo, Paul Schrader, come at me. I think First Reformed is a ripoff of so many better movies. It's like, so I'm tired of this First Reformed shit right now. I don't mean to be Tekashi 6ix9ine right now or anything like that. I'm laying it down. It's like, I understand, like, yo, you're sentimental about previous times, previous movies and so forth in the 70s. But I think people were smoking in movie theaters at that time, probably. You know, it was probably hard to breathe in those theaters. But we're talking about, like, audiences and how people watch movies in 2018 to the 70s?
Essentially, he's saying that they're not paying enough attention. They don't see it as art. And I'm like,
oh, please, come on.
It sounds like the Ethan
Hawke
interview.
People love his movie because it is art. And they're willing to not acknowledge how much he rips from so many other movies to make something that is an original screenplay. But if you watch Brisson or if you watch Winter Light, especially Winter Light, it's a ripoff. Only he
Akira,
could get away with that, and it's driving me crazy.
Because he's Paul fucking Schrader.
Yeah.
All right. Matt, thoughts?
I mean, it was kind of a slap to the... I love First Reformed. I saw it three times, and I think it's like my number four of the year currently or something. Mm-hmm. But when I saw this, it reminded me a lot of that Ethan Hawke interview when he was talking about how, you know, people are too focused on superhero movies and they don't see things as art. And it came off as really pretentious and kind of
coming from the guy who's in Reality Fucking Bites.
And Juliet Naked. And but the thing is, when Paul Schrader said that, it's like there are points where I can kind of get it. I think it was like William Bibiani tweeted something a couple weeks ago how, like, if you adjust for inflation, Dog Day Afternoon made as much as Ant-Man and the Wasp made this year. Domestically, like 160 million or something. And that's fascinating. And I wish we could, like, I'm sure that was a fascinating time. And I wish I was alive to experience times like that. But I also think that, I mean, I'm also appreciative of people being a lot harder on certain movies in terms of And this is so millennial of me to say, I really like the fact that a lot of critics have become so woke, because I think it gives a lot of filmmakers, it forces filmmakers to confront more their, you know, their hypocrisies more often. And so it emphasizes better writing.
And it's worth mentioning that these new Hollywood brats were the ones that fucked up the film industry in the first place. They came along and they're like, yeah, we're artsy as fuck. We're going to make the movies we want to make. And then all of a sudden, Coppola's making One for the Heart. And like, these guys were so arrogant.
Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, Heaven's fucking Gate. Thanks, Michael Cimino, you dickhead.
Rest in peace. Rest in peace.
Yeah, sorry. RIP. You know what? Fuck it. Because I'm...
Fuck you from beyond the grave.
Because there's a great book out there that I really love, and I'm reading it for the second time, called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. And if you want to fall out of love with most of these directors, except for maybe Scorsese, who is just like, yeah, he was just kind of coked out, Godard. Like, that was just him. He didn't really hurt that many people.
Yeah.
Everyone else was a fucking piece of shit, especially Peter Bogdanovich. Mm-hmm. Polly Platt will come for you in the afterlife. I just want you to know that. But, I just find it very ironic that it's, you know, Paul Schrader. Oh, poor Paul Schrader, you know, did so many drugs and was such like a psycho that he wrote Taxi Driver, you know, which is a great movie. I love Taxi Driver. Yeah, it's an amazing script. But that doesn't just suddenly in perpetuity give you the ability to comment on, you know, things. So much better back in the 70s. And I'm like, yeah, you wrote these great movies and you're still making great stuff. But just like, it was a different time, and recognize that your peers, maybe not you, but your peers were the ones that kind of fucked it up for everybody again. Clint.
I think it's really rich that Paul Schrader's shooting his mouth off right now, since he also said that he really wished he could have hired Kevin Spacey for a movie.
Is that real?
Yeah.
That
real? I think that was real. Yeah, but like, they wouldn't
I thought that was originally what you were going to ask us about.
Yeah,
so that's why.
Yeah. No. Which Schrader statement of the week?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's why
it's
I went.
New thing every time. And I mean, to a certain extent, like, I can get the instinct, because I occasionally do get frustrated at people lashing out about, like, oh, there's no original movies anymore, but then original movies come out and no one sees them. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also a product of things like the marketplace and streaming, and we have more movies available to us now than ever before. Like, they're coming out, even Netflix alone is coming out with more content that we can realistically catch up to. So it's like, what do you really expect of movie audiences today and in the 70s and stuff like this? There is more to pay attention to now, and I think even the fact that we're able to elevate you know, great movies in our own conversations over social media and stuff, I think is way more valuable than Schrader's maybe giving it credit for, because he's a grumpy old man.
Yeah.
And probably a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Well, I completely agree with that. The ability to create our own, you know, idea of what is a great film, and you know, the segmentation and stratification of kind of film people and being this type of person and being this type of person, what you will and won't see, you know, it does. Although we do talk about how in the current times we are in a certain level of monoculture, but we're also in an amazing level of subculture where you can just be anything. You can create your own subculture like that, and it's really that easy. So I find that interesting. Connor, what are your thoughts on this?
I would like to kind of just speak a little bit more broadly about it, and through the lens of one of Paul Schrader's more recent movies, Dog Eat Dog, with Nicolas Cage and Willem Dafoe. I really want to give him... This is exactly how I feel about Paul Schrader. He's capable of giving you the opportunity of something that could just be your favorite fucking thing in the whole world, right?
Yeah.
Dog Eat Dog, Nicolas Cage, my favorite. Willem Dafoe, I love him. employing two of my favorite fucking musicians, the most creative drummer in the entire world right now, D'Anthony Parks, with his writing partner Nicky Casper and We Are Dark Angels doing the score. Fucking awesome. And it gave me such high hopes for it, and then it comes out and it's a piece of shit. Yeah. and that's like what I think about Paul Schrader is, like, I think in this day and age it's kind of hard to have heroes, right? It's kind of hard to have these like cinematic superheroes that you can look up to, and I think that Paul Schrader is one of those people, because he turns in consistently really uneven work, and unless you're like some super genius that can put in everything and everything that you do, like, you just shit out gold bricks, I mean, then maybe you can have a license to say some of that kind of grumpy old man shit like you were saying, but he has had a really uneven career, and he's kind of a bastard, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, who gives a shit what this guy,
like,
is,
imagine
saying
him saying
point.
This around the time the Canyons came out.
I was
out.
Just gonna say, yeah. Canyons, I remember the Canyons,
which is about the cinematic experience too. It even began with those images of like dead ass movie houses.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. So yeah, that's been his course.
Similarly
for a while.
To Transformers: Age of Extinction.
Yes, oh, yes,
good lord.
Both films about the death of cinema.
And Age of Extinction has Chicago, and they both has yeah. the Uptown Theater in it, right?
That's right. Yeah,
yeah.
Michael Bay thank is you, the Michael. Last American auteur. Thank you so much to everybody.
You joke.
Sign off like that.
We can't. You joke.
No.
You love him or hate him, he is an auteur, and I will back that
and
up.
He is American. Right. And he is American. And he is American.
We can confirm
all
that.
All American.
All right. Let's go down the table, and everybody say where we can find you. Clint, you start.
You can find my work at consequenceofsound.net, as well as the podcasts Alcohollywood and Nathan Raven's HappyCast.
You can find my reviews at filmmonthly.com. I'm at Twitter at SepolaMatt.
You find me on the internet at RogerEbert.com and Twitter at NickAllen_Redux.
Oh, and I'm on Twitter at Alcohollywood.
Fantastic. Thank you all so much for coming in. Can't wait till next time. You've been listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we'll see you all next week.